Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week's edition is focused on an important Kentucky tradition, storytelling in the written form, beginning with a threat to future generations of Kentucky literature. And we'll get to that in a moment, but you'll also hear from Lexington publisher Katerina Stoykova on how to get your work out there as a book, as well as some important resources for budding writers. And finally, a prime example of how it's done, as Kevin Nance sits down in the studio with Silas House to discuss his debut book of poetry, All These Ghosts, including some readings from the book that you don't want to miss. First, the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning is a Lexington landmark and a legacy to a community that tends to punch above its weight in the literary arts, as evidenced by the many established authors and local literary icons and poets who have honed their craft there and have given back by conducting classes and workshops at the center. It's a nonprofit offering seasonal classes in writing, publishing, and languages. They tutor students, grades K through 12. Youth and family programs and exhibits are a regular feature, as well as outreach programs for children and adults, all designed to encourage people to explore and to express their voices through imaginative learning and the literary arts. And now much of this is endangered, and here to discuss that with us is the Carnegie Center's Executive Director, Jennifer Maddox. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jennifer.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate you having me on today.
Well, Jennifer, the Trump administration's proposed budget for fiscal year 26 calls for the elimination of the National Endowment for the Arts, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and other cultural agencies. In the weeks following the rollout of that budget proposal, NEA grantees in Kentucky were notified that their awards had been terminated or withdrawn from consideration. How has this affected the Carnegie Center?
Well, we were one of those nonprofits that received a very sudden email that said that our grant with the NEA that was currently, you know, the projects were already taking place and being planned, that that was eliminated or terminated effective May 31st. So when we got this email, it was on May the 2nd. So less than a month notice, the things that they had even cited as the reasons for terminating the grant were lies. They said that the general terms and agreement that we had signed said that they could terminate the grant at any time if the president's priorities changed. And it said a number of other things, too, that, you know, as somebody who reads and writes, I went back and looked at those terms and conditions, and that was not in there, nor did it say that they had the ability to change the date on which they would end their support for our current project. And it was supposed to go through the end of June. So you better believe I was one of those people who was writing an appeal for that termination.
Is the uncertainty around this proposed budget, it hasn't been passed yet by Congress or signed by the president, but is that uncertainty, is it posing planning difficulties for you and your staff?
Fortunately, we have so many expenses. We were able to figure out ways to spend that money by the end of May, but we still went ahead and appealed that just because if we didn't, we didn't want there to be any standards that we had let them terminate our grant in the future. They've already told us that they are not going to fund our project for the fiscal year that we're now in. And one of our concerns is the support that we get from the Kentucky Arts Council. We know that they have important support that they get from the National Endowment for the Arts, as do all other states' arts agencies in the country. And without that funding, that really is going to be a hole that Kentucky as a state cannot fill.
So it has a domino or ripple effect.
It absolutely does. LexArts here in Lexington also gets some of their funding from the National Endowment for the Arts. I think they said they had three, maybe four grants with NEA. So it's not just the National Endowment for the Arts, but all the other nonprofits and organizations that they fund as well that are being impacted.
Now, there was a ruling in a recent lawsuit that directly relates the elimination of NEH funding to the Constitution. What can you tell us about that case?
Sure. Well, there is an organization called the Authors Guild. It's a national organization, and I'm a member of it, and I've been watching their news. And one of the things that the Authors Guild does very well is they are incredible advocates for writers, for the humanities, the arts. And they recently, with about eight authors, filed a lawsuit. And the U.S. District Court of the Southern District of New York ruled that the NEH and DOGE's official mass termination of these NEH grants was unconstitutional. They said that it violated the First Amendment, and it also violated the Administrative Procedures Act.
So where does it go from here? Do you know if the administration's appealing that up? These things tend to go onto a track to the Supreme Court eventually.
Right. And one thing I know about the Authors Guild is they have actual attorneys on their staff. Mm-hmm. This is their job. They go out and they advocate. And so I have a feeling that this is just the beginning. Although it did say in the ruling, though, that even though this was the Authors Guild and eight authors, that in this lawsuit, it said that there was adequate information that this also would be applicable to the approximately 14 other individual NEH grantees and subgrantees whose grants were terminated in April.
Having to fight these issues in court is terribly expensive. It's terribly time-consuming. You could be doing so much else without having to worry about this. Can you comment on that?
Well, it just feels like that the programs for writers, readers, thinkers, and learners are under attack right now. And if you are attacking them from multiple sides with all the eliminations and all the decreased funding that we have heard about from DOGE just in this year alone, it keeps people very busy. And if you're busy doing that, how can you focus on some of the other things that are going on, not only in the news, but that you need to be focusing on as an organization? So it's just a terrible time for our country to be trying to accomplish anything in the creative industry or even in the education industry.
So, worst case scenario, Jennifer, let's say Congress passes and President Trump signs a fiscal 26 budget that does eliminate the NEA, the NEH. What will that look like here on the local level, specifically at the Carnegie Center?
For us, the National Endowment for the Arts grant that we have received the last several years, it has helped us fund our Books in Progress conference, our writing classes that we offer for ages 14 and up, because it does our adult and our teen programs, writer mentoring, and also the Carnegie Center Author Academy. And knowing that the Carnegie Center Author Academy likely would not get a grant for fiscal year 26, we had to put that program on hiatus already. So we knew going into this fiscal year that the funding would be gone. We just knew. And so for hopefully 1 year, that program's on hiatus. But who knows? It depends on when the funding is available. And, you know, for the Carnegie Center Author Academy, it's a program that is for people who want to work on their writing, whether that's they want to be a better writer or they have a project like a book that they are working toward, and they need the dedicated help of a mentor to take that project to the next level, to reach for their writing goals. We've had people who've gone into this program who have gone on to publish their books. And one of those was Ellie Kilcoyne, a Lexingtonian. She wrote a young adult book, and that book went on to win a national award. This is just one example of the kind of people that are being impacted by the loss of this funding. We're going to have people who have projects that are worthy of awards, of publication, that they're not going to be able to get those projects out into the world. So it's a stifling of the creative expression that's happening through the loss of this National Endowment for the Arts funding, not just for us, but for all the other organizations. So one of the things about literary arts organizations, you're very rarely going to find a grant that will actually support your projects. Most of the grants out there are for visual and performing arts. I would say for every one of the visual and performing arts grants, there might be 1 out of 100, maybe even of 1,000, that actually will fund literary arts programs. Funding for literary arts programs is so rare to find. And National Endowment for the Arts was one of the shining stars because they were one of the ones that were funding projects for writers through fellowships, but also organizations like ours. They also support the publication of some books and other documents that, you know, whether they're magazines and other things. So when you lose that funding, there's nobody who's stepping up to take their place because there just isn't anybody. So that means when you found something that was very rare to fund your projects and now that's gone, what are you going to do next? You're probably not going to find another grant.
Well, the Carnegie Center
is an important part of the literary infrastructure in our community, which has been really strong, especially lately. We're seeing an awful lot of interest in writing and a lot of production. Publishing is going on here. It's a pretty exciting time. But it sounds like this is a pretty serious erosion of that infrastructure, and that extends over to public education as well.
It does. You know, at the Carnegie Center, we use the literary arts as a vehicle for literacy, whether it's for a child or it's for an adult. And so when we have youth meeting authors, for example, a program we take into the school systems, you know, this Kentucky author comes in, shares their work with the students, and then we have been giving out free copies of the book that the author signs to the students at that event. It's one way that it encourages kids to not only read, but also sometimes we have workshops tied to that. And so they're learning how to be better writers as well. That's just an example of one way we use the literary arts with kids. But even with adults, if you think about it, to keep your brain active, lifelong learning is one of the best ways to do that. And by expressing yourself through writing, it not only provides this creative outlet that a lot of people are looking for, but in some cases, it's providing new sources of income. It might be providing some written stories that could be passed down through the family, or, you know, it might be something else, addressing an issue of importance to you. So it's more than just stimulating the mind. It's about the benefit to the community because of what you do with your writing.
Well, since you received that letter and have been contemplating what it means and dealing with all this, have you been in touch with Congressman Andy Barr?
I have. As a writer myself, I choose to send emails because, or use the online form, I should say, because then what I am thinking is not only written down, but they have to document every single one of these letters that they get, I'm told. The same is true with a voicemail, if you're able to leave one. But I want my words, not the words of someone who's maybe taking a message, to be the ones that are the record. And so that's why I personally like to have a letter. And I've sent more letters to our congressmen and senators this year alone than I probably did in the last 20 years of working at the Carnegie Center.
Any response?
The generic, we got your email. Thank you for contacting us. And then the same old song and dance about this is what I think or this is what's best for the community. It's definitely not a personal response, and it doesn't necessarily make me feel like what I had to say was being heard. Even when you say something to Andy Barr, you know, in your email, that you're saying this is what's happening at the local level. And it's not just things at the federal level. It's the local nonprofits that are the ones that are hurting. And then there's still just no response at all about that.
You know, when we hear that such an important treasured asset as the Carnegie Center is facing these difficulties right now, I think all of us feel a little bit helpless. What can a person who values the center and its services do to help out here?
Well, one of the ways that people can support not only the Carnegie Center, but any nonprofit that's struggling right now is to provide contributions, if you're able to do that, whether that's a monthly pledge or a one-time gift or multiple contributions. Right now, when we don't have the funds to even pay some of the stipends we would like to for featured authors, having contributions would help us in a major way be able to continue to deliver the programs this year, because not only of loss of National Endowment for the Arts money, but from some of our other grantors who were impacted by what's going on at the national level, both with the stock market and with tariffs and with other internal practices that are changing, we've lost some of our other grants for our children's programs even. And so if you want to offer a free class for kids so that they can improve their reading or their math skills, but you don't have any grant funders who can provide the support for that, then that to me says that there's a big problem in this country. It's not just happening in our nonprofit, but when you can't fund basic children's literacy programs, that's a huge problem. And that's what's going on in our community. So people could definitely step up. They can support the nonprofits through their contributions, but also volunteerism. Right now, people need volunteers because maybe they are short-staffed, maybe they've had to let people go, or maybe just like with us, we use volunteers all year long. And so, you know, some years we've had 300 to 400 volunteers a year that help us run our programs. So we are always on the lookout for volunteers, including for our tutoring program, which is getting ready to start here in September. And then, of course, advocacy. Advocate for the nonprofits and for the arts organizations, the education institutions. Advocate, you know, not only with your elected politicians, but in other ways if you're able to.
Jennifer, before we go, I know that you made a couple of trips to Concord, Massachusetts.
Yes.
And you've noticed something of a before and after. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah. So I just happened to be in Massachusetts in 2024. And I said to myself, I'm going to go to Concord. There were multiple reasons I wanted to go because there are some literary destinations there. Louisa May Alcott grew up in Concord, but it's also the site where the Old North Bridge is. And I had read about it in school, of course, but I thought, well, I'm right here. I'm going to stop and I'm going to take a look. Well, that day that I went just happened to be Patriots Day. And when I arrived in 2024, there were people dressed in period costumes reenacting, you know, the Revolutionary War. And it was interesting just to, you know, see the energy and the activity and all these signs. And it was a celebration of American freedom and all the values that are so important to our country. Well, in 2025, I went back to Concord because I wanted to get a little bit closer to the bridge because it was so busy before I couldn't get there. I actually wanted to walk on the bridge and I wanted to see that site. And while I was in Concord, in the same place where the shot heard from around the world took place on that bridge, there were signs. One of them said, "Oppose tyranny." Another one that was on a church said, "We believe in democracy." And as I'm driving through this small town and I'm seeing those, it was just, it made the hairs raise up on my arms to think that all these years later, we're still fighting for those same freedoms. And they recognize this there.
Jennifer Maddox, she's Executive Director at the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning in Lexington, and we thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you having me on today.
Sherry Robinson's concern, she's a retired vice provost and professor of English at Eastern Kentucky University and the author of 3 novels. Sherry, I wonder if you could share your perspectives about the implications and maybe the consequences of what's happening right now, the defunding of major cultural resources such as the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, and more generally, education itself. Where are we going?
I'm afraid of where we're going. The arts are extremely important to understanding who we are as human beings. And artists, regardless of what area of art they are producing, navigate those human complexities. So I think the more that we defund the NEA or NEH, the harder it's going to be for artists to be able to produce the kinds of things that really help us challenge ourselves. And I think that's what a lot of art does, is it really challenges our way of thinking. And same with education. As an educator, I know the importance of learning. And I think that the attack that's been on education, and I've just recently read about House Bill 4 and in Kentucky, and how that is, we're doing away with diversity, equity, and inclusion in education in ways that are going to be harmful for decades to come. And I think that's what I'm concerned about, is that this isn't just a now problem. This is something that's going to affect us for a long time.
I've heard speculation that, well, let's say this only goes on for another 3.5 years and there's a complete sea change of leadership in 2028 and it can all be put back. Is that really true? It seems as though a lot of this dismantling is long term.
I think the pendulum typically swings, but it's gone so far right now that I think it will take a long time, and in some cases, if ever, to rebuild back the gains that we had made over decades.
Sherry Robinson will be on the team of authors and publishers leading the agenda for this year's Appalachian Writers Conference, set for September 2nd through the 4th in Berea. My question for conference founder and organizer Melissa Newman. Has there been a chilling effect? Are you concerned that the current administration, especially the rhetoric that we're hearing, is posing threats to free expression, giving authors pause, even if what they're writing is fiction?
Absolutely. And I completely understand that. It seems that we are in a situation, which is exactly what this administration wanted, is that we're starting to police ourselves and each other. And if you use words like unique and special and those kinds of things, it gives you pause. And it's why? Why am I starting to rethink that particular word? Why am I starting to rethink the title of my book? And I do think that it is part of that self-policing. But instead of just making these decisions on our own and wondering, you know, did I do the right thing? Am I being too heavily influenced by the times? I think that it is that community of writers that can keep us thinking together and knowing that we're not out here by ourselves in this creating world thinking about what do we do next.
The Appalachian Writers Conference will be an opportunity to have conversations about these issues. I asked Melissa for more details.
So the cost of the conference is $495, and that includes 5 meals. That also includes lots of good instruction. So if you go to the website, www.appalachianwritersconference.com, you will see all of our faculty members. We also have Trace Conger. He won the Seamus Award in crime fiction. He's coming to us, as well as a repeat from last year, Susan Furlong, who was a New York Times best-selling crime writer of the year, and many others.
And this is in Berea. Where exactly in Berea will it happen?
So we are at historic Boone Tavern, and so it's a very nice place to relax and think about writing. That coziness is there. And then also, we have a literary agent this year for the first time.
Oh, wow.
Her name is Jackie Cruzy, and she is with Focused Artists Literary, and she will be accepting, upon signups, 8-minute pitches from writers who have completed works. And so we are very excited about that.
And do you have a block of rooms at the...
Yes.
Okay.
We absolutely do. And our conference, because we're so large, we have the run of the hotel the whole time that we're there. And it's like this running joke because it's like we have every room.
That's Melissa Newman, founder of the Appalachian Writers Conference, happening September 2nd, 3rd, and 4th in Berea. And you can get more information online at appalachianwritersconference.org. Writers in and around Lexington have a new home. The Lexington Writers' Room recently expanded into a large second-floor suite above Frank and Dino's restaurant at the corner of Mill and Short Streets. According to their website, the Lexington Writers' Room offers local active writers and visitors affordable, collaborative, and supportive workspaces so they can produce more work and expand their readerships. And you can find out more about that online at lexwritersroom.com. Coming up after the break, publisher Katerina Stoykova has her own definition of poetry.
To me, poetry is personal work for public consumption.
And Silas House on his new book of poetry, exploring the complexities of his Eastern Kentucky home place.
When you feel that much complexity about something, it's good to write a book about it.
I'm Tom Martin. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at WEKU.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top 5 stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app,
Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin, and we're highlighting Kentucky literature this week. And with me here in the studio is Katerina Stoykova, author of award-winning poetry books in her native Bulgarian as well as the English of her American home of 30 years. She is the creator and senior editor of the Lexington independent publisher Accents Publishing, which has released over 100 books of poetry, anthologies, short story collections, novels, and nonfiction. Katerina also mentors many of the writers and poets among us and recently released The Poet's Guide to Publishing. And in a time when there seems to be a whole lot of writing going on around here, I've invited her to come over and give us a guided tour of that book. Welcome, Katerina.
Thank you, Tom. Wonderful to be here.
And so first, is it just me, or does it seem to you that there's an awful lot of writing going on around town these days? It seems to be a lot of interest.
Yeah, there is a lot of writing going on, and I don't know if it's more than it was before, but right now it's more visible than ever with all the wonderful opportunities that we have. And I dare say we have amazing supportive community here that fosters the sense of safety to be yourself in front of the mic and to share yourself with the audience.
That's a real daunting thing, isn't it? Especially when you're standing up there, maybe for the first time, and trotting out what you've written. It must be kind of breathtaking.
Well, I have my own definition of poetry. To me, poetry is personal work for public consumption. And that's what we do. We retreat and we work with ourselves. We get to know ourselves better. We put that on paper. And then we share that with others and they connect, and then something gets unlocked. And people who connect with the poem can pass a personal block with less effort, in a more focused way, with fewer things to learn the hard way.
You have published The Poet's Guide to Publishing. It's organized in 5 parts: concept, arrangement, revision, publication, and promotion. It's a guidebook for anybody seriously considering getting that book written and out there in the world. So to give our listeners a sense of what's on offer in these pages, I'd like to briefly focus on one topic within each of these parts, if I could. For example, for concept, maximizing the chances for success.
Maximizing chances for success might mean writing in teams and figuring out what your writing is obsessed with and what is the larger topic in the pile of poems that you're facing. And then once you see that, then ask yourself the question, what else can I write within this theme? And very often, you cannot tell that yourself. You need a trusted reader to read that pile, this topic, and say, oh, these are wonderful poems, and I would want to know more about this part of it and this part of it and this part of it. And then you can take this list and see if you can follow up. And sometimes you can write those poems and sometimes you cannot write those poems. And sometimes you have already written, but you haven't thought to include them in this consideration set. Researching helps also. Researching the larger topic. Some people give themselves research retreats besides the well-known writing retreats. But generally spending time with your writing and keeping it in your head, giving a space to your head for your writing can really maximize your chances for success.
All right, arrangement. And I landed on qualities needed at this stage.
If I may, I'll tell you a story about how I came up with, to me, an innovative idea about how to arrange a poetry collection. I used to own ferrets, like four of them.
Wow.
Fan of ferrets, I guess. I think they're the cutest animals ever. But when you go to buy ferrets, the shop owners, they don't sell them to you one at a time. If they have been bonded together, they'll sell you either both of them or none. That, of course, could have been a marketing trick, but, you know, I succumbed. So that's how I came up with the idea of bonded pairs in poetry, because I noticed that no matter how drastically I arrange a group of poems, some of them, like those two, they would stay together. No matter what I try to do, they just are bonded. So I would treat them as a bonded pair, and I would either move both of them or none. So one of the things that is so daunting when we're arranging a book of poems is that there are so many staggering number, really, of combinations. And once you start bonding the poems, that drastically reduces the number of combinations.
Revision, signs that the manuscript is just not ready or that it's ready.
Sometimes, no matter how much we want a manuscript to be ready, it is not. And in reality, we know it. If we're really honest with ourselves, and especially if we've been writing and publishing a while, we have kind of like realistic sense of the quality of our work. And sometimes we are not psychologically ready to let it go. But either way, you know, there is a degree of readiness, and if it's not, it's not. Another sign is that if every time you get your hands on your manuscript, you change it drastically, then the manuscript hasn't settled enough in order to stay in a fixed form.
Is there ever a stopping point? Do writers get to that point where they are completely satisfied with what they've written?
I have an MBA degree, and one thing that I learned in economics is the concept for the area of diminishing returns.
Hmm.
So when I find myself that my editing shifts into the area of diminishing returns, then I know that I'm done and I'm just afraid to submit, or I'm just waiting for the right opportunity, or I'm waiting for to catch up in my mind that to let it go.
Okay, so we've decided we're ready to submit that manuscript. What do we want to look for in a publisher?
Well, there is no such thing as a perfect publisher. I can say that both as an author and as a publisher myself. So, but there are things that I look for in a publisher. One of them is that the publisher has a website and a web presence. And then to look at the authors. And I really like to see their bios. And if they publish people of different backgrounds and different stages of their career, I find that very encouraging, because that shows me that this publisher is looking for exciting and interesting work more than university professors, for example. And then when I look at the website, I also check out the book's covers, the covers of the books that this publisher publishes, because and actually I want to see if I like them, because if I don't like them, chances are I won't like the cover that, you know, that they will make for my book.
Mm-hmm.
The cover of the book you publish, whether you like it or not, that changes the relationship that you have with that book. Distribution, you need to look for a publisher with a distribution. Also ask yourself how long they have been in business or in existence, the longevity of a press. As a publisher, I know that even though we never compromised on the quality of our books, we learned things along the way and became better at it. So if a press has been around for a while, then that gives me the confidence that chances are that it will continue to be in existence. Book fairs and conferences are another thing that I would look for to see if the press goes to book fairs and conferences. And that tells me that as an author, I could go and I could have a book signing at their table. I would look for the attention to detail, because the attention to details shows professionalism in every area, really, of life. But, you know, when you open a book and how well it's proofread, it really shows. And then the one thing that people don't think about, but it's important to notice, how does this publisher price their books? Would you be able to afford to buy your own books, albeit at a discount, once the book comes out? So all these things come into play when you're researching a press.
Well, Katerina, what's your advice for people who have a story in them? They have a real story to tell, and they might even have the skills and the talent to tell it on paper, but they're finding it really difficult to commit to writing that book. It's almost scary, the thought of putting it down on paper. How can they break through that?
Well, first of all, tell them that, yes, it is scary, and yes, it is difficult, but do you want to do it? And if you want to do it, at some point, you're going to have to make it a priority, because it is much easier to not do it. But for me, I knew that I wouldn't want to not give myself a chance. So for anybody who has the skills and the story, I would say do it first for yourself and then decide what to do with it. And write that book like you're writing for just yourself. Do not edit it. Do not censor yourself. Take all the risks. And then you can decide after that what the next steps might be. So telling your story is not optional. Telling it to the world might be.
Accents publisher, creator, and senior editor, and herself a published author, Katerina Stoykova. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Publishing on September 9th, All These Ghosts by that Kentucky rock star of letters, Silas House. Kevin Nance sat down with Silas for a conversation here in our studio.
Silas, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to start by telling you that when you were announced as the Kentucky Poet Laureate a couple of years ago, I had to fend off friends of mine from out of state, not from Kentucky, who were not familiar with the practice of having poets laureate sometimes be fiction writers, not necessarily known for poetry. And somebody sent me a message and said, why are they nominating Silas House, who is a novelist, as a poet laureate? And I had to explain that there's the tradition of that. Then the question was, well, has he published poems? Yes, I think he has. I've heard him read them. Has he published a book? And I had to say, well, no. And now you have answered your critics by publishing a book of poems, your first book of poems. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. I also have to say, you don't have to publish a book to be a poet. You
know? That's true.
That would be my response.
That's true. That's true.
You just have to write poems.
That's right. Did your time as poet laureate at all make you think more about poetry or nudge you in more in the direction of writing more poetry?
Well, I've always written poetry ever since seventh grade. It's just that I haven't published as much of that as I have prose, but I've always loved poetry. Over the last few years, I have dedicated myself to learning more about the craft of poetry because I was mostly trained as a prose writer. And so in learning more, of course, that made me write more poems. while I was poet laureate, I was required to write more poems because you get asked to write occasion poems, which are very hard to do. That's my least favorite form of poetry, simply because poetry should be organic. And when you're writing an occasion poem, you lose some of that freedom, you know. However, I ended up writing a couple of occasion poems I really love. Three of them are in the book. So I was writing more poetry. And I also was being asked that question, why don't you have a book of poetry? And after my poem that I read at Governor Beshear's second inauguration got out in the world, I started getting offers from publishers specifically for a poetry book. So,
and this is the result?
Yes.
I thought maybe I'd ask you to read the beginning of the book. It's sort of a prologue poem, and it's an unusual poem in the context of the book for reasons that we'll get into. But maybe you could read that first poem in the book.
Sure. This is Lost Place, and it's after A.E. Housman. I hear a song that kills, yet is a hinge from my country so far, so close. What is that green remembered ridge? What trees? What pastures are those? I float above crowded porches and tables, all these ghosts just beyond my reach. I would love them more if I was able to go back in time and believe. I recall the wild places, fecund, rich. I wade into the creek, diaphanous myself. Am I haint or witch? Listen to me. Once here was happiness. Now this is the land of the beguiled. I see it before me so plain, the little paths I trod as a child and will never mark again.
That's a beautiful poem. I think you said in an Instagram post that I happen to have heard recently that you were leery of including it as the first poem in the book, in part because you didn't want to raise expectations that it would be typical in the book. It's not typical in the sense that it most of your other poems don't rhyme.
Right.
They're not, quote, after poems.
Yeah. Most of my poems have embedded rhyme, but they don't rhyme at the ends of the lines and, you know, have that form. But my poetry editor felt that it was strong enough that lots of readers don't even notice that it rhymes at the ends of the lines. And so it wouldn't set up that expectation. It is an after poem, meaning that it's written in homage to or in conversation with an earlier published poem. A Shropshire Lad is one of my favorite books of poetry ever. It was published in the very late 1800s by A.E. Housman, one of the earliest books to explore gay issues, although subtly it's there. But even more than that, it's about love for a place and feeling conflicted about a place, and those themes show up throughout this book. So it just made sense for it to be the prologue.
That poem also contains what became the title of the overall book.
Yeah.
All These Ghosts. And what does that title mean to you?
Well, it's a book about being haunted and about being the haunter. I am haunted by the culture I grew up in. I can never get over being from a small town in eastern Kentucky. It's a huge part of who I am. It's shaped everything about me. Being working class has shaped everything about me. Being judged on those two things in particular has shaped me in lots of ways. Being a little gay boy growing up in that culture with those aspects to it has shaped everything about me. And so I think I carry a lot of heartache about how much I love the place, in that it's a different place now than when I grew up, but it's also, I can't live there anymore politically. I'm not able to live there because of politics. And that deeply hurts me every day I think about it. And so, you know, when you feel that much complexity about something, it's good to write a book about it.
Is that what you mean, by the way, in the line about this is the land of the beguiled?
Yeah.
You feel like the people are beguiled by others who are telling them to think one way or another about this or that, in a way that maybe wasn't so true when you grew up there?
Well, it's hard to talk about because I don't ever want to generalize my people, and I certainly don't want to paint them in a negative light. I think what I'm saying in that one word is that the people I know from where I'm from are very complex people, and they're very loving people. And so to see so many of them embrace and defend and vote for policies that I find reprehensible is just mind-boggling to me, and I can't rectify it. So I think when you love something deeply, you must also critique it deeply. Some people don't hold with that, and they think if you critique something, then you're showering it with hatred or belittlement, and that is never what I want to do. I critique where I'm from because I love it so deeply. And so I'm just thinking about, you know, all those complexities with that line and my astonishment that so many loving, kind people that I know and have known my whole life are on board with some of the policies that they are.
I think anytime anybody writes about Appalachia, whether you're an Appalachian yourself or not, you might have a sense of having to tread a fine line between Appalachian stereotypes, which we all know what they are, and Appalachian nostalgia that leads one to look back with rose-colored glasses about what Appalachia was like. Did you feel like you were walking that line in this book?
I didn't feel like I was walking that line, but I knew that some readers are going to put that on it no matter what, because to romanticize a place is just as stereotyping it as to vilify it. But some people have the idea that, you know, you must only put a positive spin on something. I think that anytime you're simplifying a place and a people, you're stereotyping them. What I try to do is examine the complexities of the place. I think about what I love about it and what frustrates me about it. And I write about that. Some people get mad at me about that, but you just have to tell your truth the best way you can. And I never do it out of any kind of malice. I always do it out of a place of love and trying to understand.
You have a wonderful poem called First Home. Could you read that one?
First Home. We lived in a little red and white trailer near the banks of Robinson Creek. Metal screen doors screech, brown paneled walls, bedrooms safe as wombs. Sandbox, beagle, the porch floor's concrete, cool and solid. Wooden table, four chairs. My mother there, worried with checkbook, singing to the radio. I was country when country wasn't cool. Soup, beans, cornbread, chow chow, grilled cheese, pickle bologna, saltines, blue TV glow in a darkened room. The Waltons, little house. Winston Lights, peach knee-high, bottles of Stroh's, solitaire, rummy. The women laugh, wash dishes, hips touching. Men build a gnat smoke. Music from the church next door, feet stomping, hands clapping, drums. God. I went with my daddy into the woods to dig a dogwood he planted in our yard. I hope the tree grows there today. I'm a long way gone from that place, yet marked by it still. They called us trailer trash, but oh, how sweet rain sounded on its roof.
One of the things I was surprised by, pleasantly so, Silas, in your book is the way you use traditional forms in many of the poems. Not all of them. Some of them are kind of free verse, but I see you're using haiku, haibun, villanelle, pantoum, sonnet. What was that process like? And I don't know, maybe you had been writing those all along, but was that a relatively recent discovery of how you could pour your poetry into those vessels?
That's definitely something I've wanted to explore more. And by the way, the poem I just read is a shaped poem in that when you look at it, it looks like trailers in a trailer park. The second line of each stanza is the porch, and the first line is the trailer. I just think using traditional forms challenges me to write a better poem. When you have to fit something into a specific count or space or shape, it forces you to think about the language in a more intense way. And that's what poets should always be doing, is thinking about the language as intensely as possible.
Is there something you found that you could express in poems that you couldn't in fiction or some other form?
I think I'm revealing a lot more about myself in poetry than I do in fiction or even nonfiction. That's not to say that every poem in the collection is absolutely true. There is some fiction in some of the poems, but it's also, poetry is a form of memoir for me. And somehow the efficiency of the poetry allows me to do that better.
Yeah. And in a more perhaps lyrical, song-like way rather than, you know, I think of prose is, has a certain, I don't know, workmanlike quality in a way, and poetry exists on some kind of, at least I say this as a poet myself, poetry exists on a higher plane somehow, yeah. And it floats above. And
well, it's easier for me to reveal growing up in a volatile household by just, you know, mentioning a line about my father throwing something,
right,
than it is for me to write an essay about growing up in a volatile household.
Yeah. I think we're running down toward the end of our time, Silas, so I'd like you to take us out by reading from the poem Little Fire, which stood out to me in the book.
Little Fire. I was always so afraid of being left behind. I was sure the rapture would take you all in the twinkling of an eye and strand me. Because I questioned too much. Sometimes I doubted. Often I pined for the lost boys who sat petulant, aflame, on the back pew. One day, the wrath was too much, so I escaped. I wandered for years, an Israelite in the wilderness. Not one of you offered shelter. I stood on your creaking porches with a suitcase at my feet, staring at the closed doors. I heard the clock striking seven inside. You watched from the curtain's edge, holding your breath. I had nothing but little creeks and trees to comfort me. Dogs, books, music, mountains. I found a family when blood left me in the cold night, but somehow I kept myself warm. All my life, you've told me I'm no good. You've said I am not worthy of God's love. But there was always this little fire burning in me, and no one ever could put it out.
Thank you, Silas.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All These Ghosts is published by Blair, an imprint of Carolina Wren Press. You can find it online at blairpub.com. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. While you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.